The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Our aim is to explore the fringe, lost civilizations, alternative science, the paranormal, and much more. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live or future guests via email or the live chat room. And remember to subscribe to us on iTunes. And now welcome to this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
And this is Where Did the Road Go? And tonight we're going to be talking to Lloyd Pye. And Lloyd Pye, welcome to the show, Lloyd.
Well, thank you. It's good to be with you.
And you have you've been doing stuff for a while, but the thing you're most famous for is the Starchild skull.
That's true.
Now, do you want to tell people a little bit of your history before that?
Well, before that, I was a writer and wrote a couple novels, and then I became a screenwriter in Hollywood in the 1980s, and I was modestly successful. I mean, not no movies done, but a couple TV shows and things like that. And then I got interested in the work of a man named Zechariah Sitchin. I had been interested in hominoids for a very long time, hominoids being the Abominable Snowman, Yeti, Sasquatch, Bigfoot, all of that. And so starting in about the early 90s, when I read Sitchin's book, The 12th Planet, I began, because I was a writer and I knew, you know, what I was doing in that realm, I decided that I was going to blend his knowledge about human origins with my own knowledge about hominoids and create something different that no one had ever done before, and that was a book called Everything You Know Is Wrong. And from Everything You Know Is Wrong, that put me on the map, and that attracted the people who owned the Starchild skull to get in touch with me to ask me if I would try to help them figure out what it is. And that was 14 years ago. And I undertook it not having any idea what a monumental task it was going to prove to be. But I have felt since almost the beginning, since the first year of the 14 years, that the Starchild skull represents a real true alien skull. I don't have any doubt now about that because of DNA and things that have come to light in the last couple of years, but it's definitely, in my opinion, I don't have any doubt, it will prove out to be a absolute alien skull, probably of a great type alien.
Okay, all right. Want to tell people a little about where it was found and how it came into these people's possession that then brought it to you?
Sure. It was found in Mexico, in the Copper Canyon area, about 100 miles southwest of Chihuahua, in about 1930. And at that time, a young teenage girl who was of Mexican heritage, her parents had come to the States, become citizens when she was a teenager, and so they went back home for the first time to the home village, and she, while there that week, went wandering well away from the village and found a mine tunnel. And in that mine tunnel, she saw a human skeleton lying on the ground, and she noticed a mounded up grave, shallow type grave, beside the skeleton that was lying on its back. And she noticed that what she called a misshapen hand was wrapped around the upper arm bone was emerging from the dirt of the graves. I should have said that. Emerging from the dirt of the grave and was wrapped around the upper arm bone of the human that had laid down. Very dramatic scene. So she could see that the grave was not compacted by rain or anything like that. It was like, you know, as fresh as almost the day that it was dug. So with her own hand, she was able to dig it away, and she found what she called a misshapen skeleton there. She ended up recovering the two skulls that had suffered some damage, but she brought the skulls back to the States with her as souvenirs, and she kept them her whole life. And just assuming that the weird one, what they called the weird one, was just a deformity, a human deformity of some kind. It didn't occur, certainly not in 1930. There there was no knowledge of things like UFOs and aliens, so it just never occurred that it was anything other than some kind of deformed human. And so when she kept them her whole life until the early 90s, and when she found out that she had a terminal illness in the early 1990s, she willed them to some friends of hers. Her husband was not comfortable with the two skulls in the cardboard box in the garage, so she gave them to some friends who kept them for 5 years, and then they, too, were not particularly enthralled with two skulls in a cardboard box in their garage. So they gave them to a couple named Ray and Melanie Young. All of these people are in El Paso, from the woman right on down, El Paso, Texas. So Ray and Melanie were unique in that Melanie had been a neonatal nurse for a dozen years or so, and they both, Ray and Melanie, belonged to MUFON in El Paso, Mutual UFO Network. So they were knowledgeable about aliens, and Melanie was knowledgeable about deformity. So when these people handed over to her what they told her was going to be a deformed human, just some deformed human, Melanie knew right away that wasn't what it was. She knew there was no deformity or no combination of deformities that made a skull look like that. And furthermore, it didn't lighten the skull. Skulls weigh what skulls weigh. Human skulls have a certain weight range that they need to fit within, and this one was way outside that range, way too light. It was like a dried gourd rather than a skull. And the bone was much thinner than human bone should be. She didn't know at the time, but it turned out to be, when it came time to cut into it, much harder. Even though it's a lot thinner, even though it's a lot lighter, much harder. So from that point, Melanie believed that it was not a human skull. It was not a human deformity. It looked and had all of the physical hallmarks of a gray alien. The crease at the top of the head, the weird eyes, the very narrow and thin lower face, the very thin neck, all the things that people describe as gray aliens as having externally, this skull has that internally. So no doubt that it's real, no doubt that it's bone, but it's not like human bone, and it's not a human. Pretty much in a nutshell, that's the whole story.
All right. And I think when you first look at it, before you know any details about it, just seeing, like, there's a picture on wheredidtheroadgo.com right now of you and the skull. You hold the skull up. It almost looks like someone's face just got crunched up into the front.
Well, it's so different in so many ways. I mean, you can break it down into a number of ways. 20 points on a human skull, 10 points, 30 points. There are 25 points that we count of reference on a human skull. In the human, the star child has not a single one of those 25 that matches exactly. In other words, you can't look at a human anything, brow ridge, eye socket, ear, front of head, back of head, top of head, underside, neck, anything. Wherever you look at a point of reference on a human skull, and you look on the star child skull, the star child is different from either noticeably different to radically different, and in most cases, radically different. So, you know, it's a no-brainer from a physical standpoint. It's been a no-brainer since 1999 when I first saw it. By the end of that year, we knew all of that. But of course, science, this is not a thing that science wants to be real. This is not a thing that science wants to have to accept, alien reality. So they set a standard of proof, as they do for anything they don't like. If it's something they want, then, of course, the bar is very low. If it's something they don't want, they lift the bar of proof very high. So when it came to all of those physical differences, what they learned how to say was, well, nature can do anything. The same way when you back a religious person in the corner in a debate about religion or God or whatever, they just say, God can do anything. God can do anything. There's nothing you can hit me with that I can't say God can do anything, and I win. Well, science takes the exact same tact when they're challenged. They say nature can do anything. Nature is their God. They just turn it around and put the shoe on the other foot. Nature can do anything. So no matter how many physical differences we came up with, I always said, well, you know, no big deal. Nature can do anything, da-da-da-da, you know, and that was it. So it really comes down to DNA for us and for the Star Child. The physical end of it, that it was never going to work.
Now, one of the things that always struck me is how easily they accepted the very flimsy evidence for the Higgs boson versus sure. piles of evidence for other stuff that they dismiss. And that's a perfect example of what you just said, where the bar is very low for the things they want to find.
Exactly right. That when it's something they want to deal with and is to some way in some way to their advantage, the bar is extremely low. When it's anything that's going to be a hassle for them, something they don't want to deal with, they raise the bar up very, very high. And, you know, it's their prerogative because they're the bosses and they run things and they're sitting in the catbird seat and they take full advantage of it. And until some event comes along to shake them out of the catbird seat, they win. They get to do it. But the good news about DNA is that will work. It is their tool. It is one of their favorite tools. So if there's ever an example of being able to run somebody through with their own sword, that's the situation that we find ourselves in with the Star Child. We can prove it with DNA. There's no doubt about it. We have partial recoveries galore now, really, and it's enough to show that when we're able to sequence, when we have the money to sequence the entire genome, we will be able to prove it beyond a shadow of a doubt, beyond any, you know, we'll clear the bar. They can't lift the bar high enough that we can't prove it if we sequence its entire genome and compare that genome to human, and it's as far away from a human as we know it's going to be, then, you know, it's just over. They don't have anything they can say. They just have to accept it and move on. Aliens are real. So it's going to change history in the way that, you know, the Wright brothers flying or going to the moon. It's going to be one of those pivotal moments in human history when the Star Child is proven beyond doubt to be an alien.
But with the DNA done, does it actually prove that it's an alien or just prove that it's not a human? Because, I mean, for all we know, it could have been a time traveler or something like that too, couldn't it?
You're absolutely right. It proves it that it's not a human, but then you have the debate about where do you draw the line, okay? Where do you draw the line? Now, here's the situation. All right, human, 100%, a genome. A chimp, mind you, differs from our genome by about 2-3%. So they are 97-98% the same as us, a chimp. A gorilla differs by about 5% of the whole genome. Now keep in mind, we're talking in the range of 3 billion base pairs. 3 billion base pairs in the genome of all three species. Okay, a gorilla is 5% different, so it's 95% the same as us, right?
Mm-hmm.
A rat is about 70% the same, 30% difference. A mouse, 65% the same, 35% different. If you go all the way down to yeast, the yeast in bread, 20% the same. So everything on Earth shares the same life code to one degree or another. Everything we're going to argue, we do argue that everything in out there, and certainly in the galaxy and probably in the universe, shares the same life code we have. It's too complicated. It's just too complicated. You can't have 2 or 3 or 4 or 50 of those. It's just too complicated. Everything everywhere shares the same life code. So the Star Child, from where we are now, with several hundred million base pairs recovered, still a fraction, still a small amount, several hundred million, compared to 3 billion is still a relatively small amount. But it's enough to know. It's enough to know what's coming down the pipe when we can get the money to sequence the whole thing. And when we can, it's just going to be a slam dunk because we are right now consistently in the ballpark of less than 50% or less matching up with the Star Child. More than yeast, but less than rats and mice. Now, you tell me, are you going to call that a different kind of human, or are you going to call that an alien? what do you think the public is going to say? Now, we know what science is going to try to say. They're going to try to say, oh, yeah, it's just like the hobbits, you know? Hobbits without a single human bone in their body and clearly not a human. They're an upright, walking, ape-like creature, and yet they're being forced to be some kind of tiny dwarf human because they can't afford to let them be what they really are, which is a type of hominoid, a pygmy type of hominoid. It'll be the same thing. They'll do everything they can to shoehorn the Star Child into some kind of weird human box. But I think anyone with a particle of education is going to understand that if it comes in somewhere around 50% or less of the same DNA as a human being, that's not even an earthly thing almost. It's just an alien. It's certainly an alien life form to have a primate-like head on a body with DNA that hardly matches up with humans at all.
Now, the rest of the skeleton was lost early on, wasn't it?
Right, except for, yeah, only the skull bones. There are no postcranial bones that survived, no.
Well, what happened to the rest of it?
They were all of the bones of the skeletons. The girl in the story that I told you earlier, she tried to save both skeletons, both whole skeletons, but she didn't know. She knew she was really doing something wrong by taking them out of that mine tunnel. And so she tried to hide them in a ravine, in a gully thing under some exposed tree roots at the edge of a ravine. And sure enough, that night, the way she tells it, that a tremendous rainstorm came. Sounds from the way she told it like a hurricane, a Pacific hurricane moving into that area, because it rained for like 3 days. And when she got there, back to the place where she had hidden the bones, they were gone, just washed away. The gully had filled with the rain. It had rolled down, you know, in torrents, and the two skeletons were gone. She went downstream and looking to see if anything was left anywhere, and she found the skulls washed up into some bushes at a curve where the water just threw them into the bushes, and the bushes snagged them like a, you know, like a baseball mitt, catching the skulls. And she was able to recover those, although they were damaged in that tumble down the stream. And she just felt herself grateful to have that, took the two skulls, didn't look any farther, and she knew she could smuggle those back in her stuff. And when I say smuggle, from her family, you know, and the natives of the village, which she did, and got them back home. And I don't know how long it was before she fessed up to having them, but she did ultimately, and she shellacked them, put them in a box, cardboard box, and just kept them, like I said, as souvenirs.
Now, the other skeleton is completely human, isn't it?
Yes, completely human. Nothing unusual about it except for the fact that it was cradleborn. And so the rear of its head, from its inion to the top of its crown, the inion, if everybody reach around to the back of your own head, to the just below the middle part, the mid part of your rear of your skull, you'll feel a knot there where your neck attaches to your skull. There's a knot called the inion. And from that point, straight up, just draw, if your skull wasn't rounded but straight up to the crown, that's cradleboarding. And that person, and cradleboarding is when a native woman puts a baby on a board and swaddles it to the board so she can go out and do her work with the baby there. What you have to do to keep the baby's head from lolling around and injuring the neck as you work, you have to strap that head down. You have to lightly strap its head onto the board. And so that happened to this female, this woman. When she was an infant, she was strapped to her mother's, to a board to be carried on her mother's back. And again, very common 900 years ago. Oh, and I should have said that. The Star Child and the human skull with it have been independently carbon 14 dated at different labs at different times, and both came up with the date 900 years plus or minus 40 years. So it's very accurate dating for two different samples, and it makes it very clear that probably the story of them being found together in the mine tunnel is true, because they clearly died at the same time.
Okay. All right. That was actually my next question because I didn't think we said how old they were. Now, cradle boarding is one of the explanations for the flatness of the back of the Star Child skull, but it doesn't actually work, does it?
No, cradle boarding is the thing that just simple minds put out on the other side. You know, just but scientists live by a thing called, I'm sure you've heard it, Occam's razor, mm-hmm. where the simplest answer is probably the answer because we're able to think of simple answers. And anything we can think of has got to be the answer because we thought of it because we have PhDs and you don't know that. So one of the simple answers is if something is flat, then it was cradle board. If the rear of a head is flat, rear of a skull, it was cradle board. Got to be. Can't be anything else. And if a skull is slightly, you know, is expanded from normal, what's called bossing, where it's larger in an area, as the Star Child is in its parietals, they say, well, that means hydrocephaly, meaning water on the brain. Now, in the Star Child's case, from almost day one, we have been able to show that it was neither hydrocephaly nor cradle boarding. And yet, I don't know how it is today, it changes a lot, but on the Wikipedia coverage of the Star Child, to this day, they still argue that it's cradle boarded and hydrocephalic, when I've been saying since 1999, it can't possibly be that for this number of reasons. With the Star Child, it's the whole back end of the head, from the crown to the neck. There's no inion. There is no inion. The Star Child's neck is about half the size of your neck or my neck, right? It's the size of my wrist, about 8 inches around in that range, as opposed to standard neck of anywhere from 13 to 16 inches. It's just astounding, the difference. So the whole area of the rear of the Star Child's head, now you just go to the website, starchildproject.com, and you can see what I'm saying is true. But also when you're cradle boarded, the skull, the baby bones are so soft, they take the shape of the board that the head is being strapped against. So that female that was found with it, that area of its flatness is as flat as the table, flat as a piece of glass, flat as can be. Not you run your hand on it, you can't feel the slightest bump. It's flat. You do that with the Star Child, the whole area of the rear of the Star Child skull has all of its natural convolutions. Not flat at all, not like a board, not like glass. It has convolutions. You can see them, feel them. It just wasn't credible, just absolutely not. And with hydrocephaly, that's fluid building up inside the brain, stretching the bones out of shape. Now, with that, no matter how you cut it, the pressure is uniform from the inside out, yet the Star Child has a crease down the middle of the rear of its head. Now, literally, a subpar, an underperforming moron could see this and understand what I'm telling you. I mean, I don't mean any slight against morons. An underperforming moron can understand and see that what I'm saying is the truth. And yet, as I say, to this day, PhDs galore can't see it. And so it's in Wikipedia and other places where there are criticisms of the Star Child, and they still cling to it. Some of them have advanced to the next stage, which is to say that the Star Child must be a victim of progeria. Progeria is that horrible disease where when you're born, you start to age immediately, and you are just a boy or a girl, and you look like a very old person. You are a very old person. If you make it to the age of, say, 15, that's the equivalent of 100 to us, to normal people. So it's a tough life for those folks. And what's happening is, in the aging process, their lower faces don't grow very well. Their heads look bigger. I mean, so in some ways, they vaguely kind of outside resemble the Star Child. But their heads are round in the rear instead of flat. Their eye sockets are still human eye sockets. Star Childs are not. Their ears are still in the same place, in the same relative position. Star childs are not. And on and on, we can go through this. But the main thing is, while their bones thin out, like the star child's bone is thin, so do progeria bones. They thin out because the bones of old people thin out. But what happens to the bones of old people when they thin out? They become very, very fragile. Like a progeria victim's head is like an eggshell. Easy to crack it because they're just so fragile. The star child, much, much harder than your skull or my skull, and much thinner. They show one of the photos on the website, I'm sure, or certainly in the books, about it, Star Child Skull Essentials, the ebook, which I recommend. It shows a comparison of the humans, the thickness of the human female's skull and the star child skull, and it's almost like one-third at that point. It's really, really remarkable, and yet it's very, very hard. Now, when I say harder to cut, cutting human bone is not easy. It's hard. Human bone is hard. But the star child, for as thin as it is, it's like cutting sheet metal by comparison. I've done it, and I've watched others do it. It is really, really amazing how hard that bone is. So there's just no way and no doubt that it's not human. But this is, again, as I've said before, something science is just not interested in dealing with, because it's going to turn so many of their paradigms inside out. And none of them who sit in the power chair at this moment tonight, as you and I are talking, none of them want that to happen on their watch, because they don't want to have to deal with all the extra work it's going to mean to turn everything inside out, rewrite the books, just do all the hassles, just plain old hassles. This is just personal self-interest at work. They don't want the truth because they don't want all the hassles that are going to come with it. It's as simple as that.
Now, the skull, the bone, actually has fabric woven into it, doesn't it?
Not fabric.
Or fibers.
Fibers of some kind, but we don't know what those things are. I have to tell you, we are really puzzled by them. They're woven through the matrix of the bone like rebar through concrete, and they are very durable because as the blades cut through the bone, those fibers tend to get shredded out at the ends of where they're cut off. Now, some of them do get cut, don't get me wrong, but others, you know, resist and are left hanging on the bone or to the bone, and we have photos of that too. Now, what are they? We don't know. We don't have the money. Any money that we get is going to the genome. Mm-hmm. But once the genome is proven, just like Otzi the Iceman, once science has no choice but to accept it for what it is, then they're going to be lined up around the block begging for samples to do things, to do what they should have been doing 14 years ago. And when that time comes, then somebody's obviously going to want to work on the fibers. The problem is that there is right now no recovery, no way to do the recovery. How do you recover something like that? How do you recover it in a way that you have the sample intact? You get them, you get the fibers out. And then what kind of tests do you run on them that will be non-destructive? And how many tests can you run on them before you have to start being destructive? And things like, you know, it becomes difficult because these things are microscopic in size. I mean, microscopic, very small, clearly there, no doubt about it. All you have to do is look at them under a scanning electron microscope, and there they are. But there are no protocols for recovery, and there are no protocols for testing yet. So all these things, this technology has to be developed just specifically for the star child. We don't have the money to do anything that would be off the shelf, much less have that all be created. So it like everything, it all comes down to money. And mainstream science does their very best to keep all the money for themselves and to keep research dollars away from people like me and the people who work with me on the star child skull. They do everything they can to keep money away from people like us so we don't make them look bad, so we don't do their job the way they should be doing it and have everybody recognize that they just completely missed missed the boat on something really important, which is what they're doing with the Star Trek skull.
And just to be completely clear, so people know, these fibers and stuff, this is not like anything ever found in any other bone ever.
No bone on Earth that anybody knows about carries fibers woven through the matrix of the bone like the Star Child has. It's just another one of those clear signs that the Star Child's not human, and really not even from Earth. Clear sign.
All right. Well, we got to take a quick 45-second break. We'll be back with Lloyd Pye in just a moment.
The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live guests via email or the live chat room. You can also check out our upcoming schedule, blog, link section, book reviews, videos, and links to our Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and much more. That's wheredidtheroadgo.com.
And tonight, we've been talking with Lloyd Pye about the Star Child skull. And where can people get the e-books about this?
You can go to www.starchildproject.com, starchildproject.com. And the book is called Star Child Skull Essentials, Star Child Skull Essentials. Now, there's a book that's just called The Star Child Skull. And that covers the backstory in considerable detail. The first first 8 years of it, covered in considerable detail in a book. But the ebook is the thing that's the most up to date and certainly has the best look at the DNA evidence, which is, of course, going away, the strongest evidence.
Right. Okay. Now, I know you are a proponent of the electric universe theory as well. Correct?
Yes.
And I think that when you're talking about Occam's razor earlier, about the simplest answer being, you know, the one to go with, that seems like the simplest answer to a lot of our cosmological puzzles. But yet science doesn't want to touch that with a 10-foot pole.
Well, they don't want to give up on Newton or Einstein. Yeah. And that's really the problem, is that their whole universe, pardon the pun, is built on gravity. And the idea that gravity is the glue that holds everything together. Newton started it and everything built on that up to Einstein. But the truth of it is, gravity just doesn't have the power to do what has to be done out in space. Now, they always present this nice picture, just like the Darwin thing about life, that there were these molecules floating around in some warm pond somewhere, and lightning bolts struck the molecules, and somehow magically they were swirled together in to make the first living thing. Again, nature can do anything. No different than God can do anything. Nature can do anything. Well, it's sort of the same way with cosmologists. They say that floating out in space are these various little small tiny particles of dust, and two of them bang together and they hold, and then they bang into another one, and then they bang into another one, and they all hold, and they begin to cluster, and they begin to grow into suns and planets, and that's how everything forms in the universe. But the reality of it is, the power of gravity, and this is where the math breaks down, the power of gravity is so incredibly weak by comparison to what is needed, that the two particles of dust out there in the universe, they wouldn't go together. They would never go together. And if they did, they'd just bounce off each other like two pool balls. They wouldn't hold together. They would never, it would never start. That process would never start. So that's why you have these what are called fudge factors in the math. The math of gravity doesn't work. So they have to create these massive fudge factors called black holes, dark energy, dark matter. Do you realize, and they never blink at this, 4% of the universe is real matter, like Earth and, you know, the planets and the suns and everything that we see. 4%, and the rest of it, the rest of the universe, is dark matter. and dark energy. Why? Because that has to be the case to make the math work for gravity, because gravity doesn't have the power. Mm-hmm. But electricity, electrified plasma, electricity has the power. It is based, the universe is based on electricity. The glue that holds everything together is electricity. Not electricity as you think of in lightning bolts. Imagine it as static electricity or something, you know, a milder form of it, but right. still a different form of it. But electricity is at the base of everything. And if you put electricity in those formulas where the gravity doesn't work, you put electricity in there, the formulas work fine. You don't need any of the fudge factors. The Big Bang, you need the Big Bang to make gravity work. The Big Bang goes away.
Yeah.
The black holes and all of these silly things that they come up with, all that goes away. You don't need that with electricity at the core of it. And that's just what the electric universe is about. It's about scientists and lots of them. I'm talking not people like me. I'm talking PhD. A lot of them who are part of the electric universe movement toward that. And just like we are going to be able to prove that the Star Child was indeed an alien, those folks at the electric universe are going to be able one day to prove, to just overwhelm the bleeding of the critics who just say, no, don't make us change. Don't make us change. We don't want to go through it. You know, that, but eventually it has to happen, and it will. And when it does, when they just like with alien life, when they start accepting that electricity is really the core of everything, and they start working with it, we're going to have free energy before you know it. When our best minds can be allowed to turn themselves to the reality of the electric universe, free energy is just around the corner. UFO flight is just around the corner. As soon as we turn ourselves loose and our scientists loose in the right directions, it's going to be amazing the kind of things that they can do. But right now, if any of them try to do that, their peers absolutely just disown them, just get rid of them, just get them out of the system. You can't buck mainstream science and live to tell the tale career-wise. You are just toast. And they all know that. That's why even in their heart of hearts, if they believe in UFOs or aliens, or if they believe in the electric universe, it takes some very, very brave individuals who are in a position where they can defend themselves against their peers, or they can't join, and they can't join openly. It's just like our geneticist, the geneticist that works with us with the Star Child. Very, very reputable guy, just credentials out the wazoo, but he can't let his name be attached to it yet, or he would be fired. He would just be fired from where he works, and he's the head of his lab. And that's just the way it is. The most conservative elements in all of science, in whatever area of science you choose, pick any of them, the ones running it, running that department, that piece of science, that branch of it, are the most conservative and the most diehard fanatics within the field. And they really make everybody else toe the line.
Yeah, it basically comes down to money and politics.
Money and you couldn't say it any better. Money and politics, exactly. Couldn't now, say it any better.
Now, Tesla was already on that path of working in the electric universe type of a field until, you know, he just kind of stopped and... But he was going in that direction.
Absolutely, and I don't think I don't think he kind of stopped. I think he was kind of stopped.
Yeah,
he was stopped because it was free energy is the last thing anybody that's in the energy business wants. You know, what do they do then? What do they do for a job? What do they do for their income? And it's a good life. What do they? You know, how do they maintain their level of wealth if their level of wealth has been achieved in the fossil fuel area of fossil fuels, are, you know, which, and it comes down to fossil fuels driving the engines that produce the electricity. Free electricity, can't have that. Look how much fuel you don't sell. Just like, I don't know if you're aware, if your listeners are aware, but alcohol, like, you know, you see ethanol in mm-hmm. the pumps and all. actually a much better fuel, pure ethanol, pure alcohol, you know, alcohol like that, than gasoline. And gasoline is actually a byproduct of petroleum engineering. And in the early days of the 1900s, it was junk. It was one of the biggest problems of the petroleum, the new petroleum industry is, what do we do with all this byproduct? And they were, in the early cars, they were all running them on ethanol, alcohol-based things. The engines run clean. They just produce water. They run cool. They never burn out. You put an engine in, no such thing as engine burnout with something like that. It was such a superior fuel, the ethanol and the alcohol were. But the petroleum industry had this huge problem of the waste product being this stuff called gasoline. What do we do with this? And so somebody said, well, maybe we could use it in engines. So they tried it in engines. It was terrible. It put out pollution. It caused the motors to break down over time. It had everything going against it. But, of course, it worked. It did work. And that's so boom. Before you know it, gasoline becomes the fuel. They bought up all the electric cable car systems around the country, except for the one in San Francisco and the one in New Orleans. Everything else, the petrochemical industry bought them up and turned it to buses. Went from electric cable cars to buses that ran on the new fuel, gasoline. And you know, and then before you know it, everything's running on gasoline, and here we are stuck with that 80, 90 years later. It's a great story. There are people out there telling that story. I'm just repeating it as I've heard it. But isn't that fascinating?
Yeah.
Money and politics. Always, always, always.
And when we were talking about DNA, what are your thoughts on Melba Ketchum and the Bigfoot DNA?
Well, I haven't seen enough there to convince me that that's really what's going on, what they really have. They're going to have to, the same thing we have to do with the Star Child. Once we have the genome, you have to publish, you have to make available on the internet everything you did. You have to put your data up there, and you have to let people who understand that data go over it to make sure you did all the right things and you didn't do anything really colossally stupid. Now, she's been doing this for 5 years. You would think that data is there and available. They've been making pronouncements about what they have within the last year or so. You would think that data could be made available. To my knowledge, what's called the raw data, not the final condensation, not the summaries or any of that, which is all, I think, as far as I know, anybody's seen. It's got to be the raw data that other geneticists can pick apart and look for, you know, make sure it was all done right. When that is posted, when any of Ms. Ketchum's raw data is posted and analyzed and passes muster of the other professional geneticists out there who will go over it, then glory hallelujah. I'm all for her. I'm all for them. But I have to remain skeptical, and I think everybody else does too, until they actually produce the raw data and let everybody see that, you know, that it is what they say it is.
And I assume when you get everything done with the Star Child, you'll be doing exactly that with it.
Yeah, you have to do that. Who's going to believe you if you won't publish your raw data?
But I think that science, even if you can prove with the DNA that this thing is not human in any way, they're still not going to accept the alien hypothesis until you can get alien DNA to compare it to.
Well, I mean, that, but how do you know we're not establishing the template of alien DNA? That's what really the Star Child is going to do. It's going to establish the template so that whenever anybody says, well, you don't have any alien DNA to compare it to, yes, you do. Here it is right here. And it really is going to come down to what I said earlier. Who are you going to believe? The scientist saying, well, it has to be some kind of human because it's on Earth, and you know, or you just going to look at the numbers, which are going to be ridiculous. The numbers are going to be ridiculous. And people like me are going to be out there saying, hey, you know, again, what I said earlier, sub-performing morons are going to be able to see the truth of it. and they're going to know that it's not what science is saying or trying to say. Logic is going to show that it isn't. And there will be TV shows about it. There will be documentary films about it. There will be debate about it on different programs on TV. And over time, and I think it won't be much time at all, science is just going to have to tuck its tail between its legs and just accept a reality they don't want to accept. Yeah, of course they'll fight, but they can't win. They can't win on the DNA. The DNA evidence is literally overwhelming. It always is. I mean, you can have 50 people standing around a crime and see something happen, and 50 people can say, I saw this. It's this person, that. If the DNA says different, the person goes free. Or if the DNA says otherwise, they go to jail. The DNA talks. I mean, it wins. If we get it, we win. And we're going to get it. We already know that because we have enough in at the sample level, at the partial level, to know what you can extrapolate very easily. You can extrapolate these things because they're like concrete. You find a chip of concrete, and you say it's concrete made of this and this and this and this, then the whole road of it is going to be that concrete. Same thing. We've got pieces of the Star Child, and we know what pieces of it are, and so we know what the whole skull, you know, is, how it's going to match, how it's going to come out. We just have to go through the motions of pulling out the whole genome, which is very expensive, a couple million, $3 million.
Now, do you think there's any connection between this skull and the elongated skulls that have been found?
No, I don't. But I will say this about the elongated skulls, which are known colloquially as the coneheads, that are found dominantly in Peru but in other places around the world. Those are not human either. Those are not entirely human. They are human-like. The Star Child is not human-like. The Star Child is alien. But the coneheads are non-humans, but are human-like, because they're non-humans, because they have brains twice the size of ours. You and I and the average person will have about a brain capacity of about 1,400 cubic centimeters. The coneheads range from 2,500 to 3,000 cubic centimeters, so average about 28, about twice the size of ours, full brain in those heads, all right? That's not us. They have human sort of like faces. They have human-like faces, but they have some distinctive differences. The way the sutures work in their skulls and different. There are a few things that are just markedly different. But I am very confident that when the DNA of the coneheads can be completed, when its genome can be completed, it will be much more like a human than the Star Child, much more. But it won't be a human. It won't match up with human. It will be something different, like, you know, Neanderthal or Denisova, or maybe more than chimps and gorillas, but not as badly skewing away from the human norm as the Star Child. No, in my mind, this is how it's going to work out.
All right. Okay. And the Star Child, do you believe that to be wholly alien or a hybrid of some sorts?
We believe for a long time that it was a hybrid. We did, because a DNA test in 204 using primers, not the next generation that takes it out like we have today, where it takes it out base pair by base pair, which is so much more accurate and precise. But in 203, 204, when there was nothing other than primers, the primer testing indicated clearly that the Star Child had a human mother and a non-human father. So we went with it as a hybrid, and its story made sense. But later, to our great surprise and shock, when we got the next generation testing done in mid to late 2010, and we began to get data from it from its mitochondrial DNA, which is how you determine, it's mother versus its father. The mitochondrial DNA made it clear that it was not going to be human at all, and it was, some of its nuclear DNA was there. So now we're just wrong. And the lab tests, the DNA lab tests that were done in 203 by Trace Genetics were absolutely cutting edge at the time, but the primers were so small, 30 to 50 base pairs long, that they could squeeze into the cracks and fool the system and make it look like you were looking at human DNA, when in fact you weren't. If those primers had been 100, 150, 200 base pairs long or longer, 500, then they would have seen right away they weren't getting matches. But because they were so small, little tiny little chips, they could find matches in the mitochondrial DNA, and so they thought that the star child had a human mother, when in fact didn't.
There's also legends, I believe you mentioned your essentials, about sky people who came down and left children.
Right. Well, this came from a woman named Paula Gunn Allen back in 1999. As soon as I started talking about it, she heard me on the radio, and she was a professor emeritus at UCLA in California, in Los Angeles. And she contacted me immediately, and she says, "My goodness, that equates almost exactly with what the star being legends of the Native Americans," which I had heard nothing about. And she said, if you go to Native American cultures throughout the Americas and down into South America and Central America, you will hear, and she said in other places around the world, but my specialty is in Native American culture, because she was part Native American herself, Native American culture in the States and Canada. And she said, if you go and talk to them about it, they have these legends about beings, star beings, coming down out of the sky to their village and picking a woman who was either barren or had no, for whatever reason, had no children. And they would make that woman pregnant, and they would announce to the village, now this woman is going to have a star being, one, you know, part her, part us, but it's going to be a hybrid child, going to look kind of like you, and we want you to raise it up to the age of 5 or 6 or 7 or 8, but at some point, we're going to come back and get it in that period, 5, 6, 7, 8 years from now, and when we come, it better be here, and it better be in good shape. Everybody better take care of it. You're on notice, kind of thing. And so, what Paula thought was that the woman found with the star child had been one of those women. She had given birth to it, that it was a child. We thought it was a child back in 1999, and we were wrong about that too. It was very much an adult, but we didn't know at first. So she said, if it was a child and that woman, you know, the person with it was its mother, then she might have, it might have died. It was clear that she had lugged its body way out in the middle of nowhere into an abandoned mine tunnel, and that she had buried it in a shallow grave with the dirt on the bottom of the mine tunnel. And then she herself laid down beside it and wrapped its arm around, its hand around her own arm, and committed suicide. She laid there and died with it. So it just seemed like one of those star being legends come to life. In every way, it led us to believe that, because it made sense. But all of that has turned out to be wrong over time, unfortunately. Star child was an adult. So whatever their relationship was, the woman who took the star child's dead body into the mine tunnel and buried it and then laid down and died with it, she wasn't its mother. We know that now because their haplogroups or their mitochondrial DNA don't match. So they're not mother and daughter. I mean, excuse me, mother and child. We don't know the sex of the star child, male or female. We don't know, so it's not mother and child. But it is adult and adult. So maybe they had a different kind of relationship. Caretaker, lovers, we don't know. We don't know. It's hard to think of lovers, but we don't know. But she obviously had the female, human female, she had an enormous amount of affection and feeling for it, because when she buried it, she laid down and died with it. So there was some intense connection between those two beings, whatever it was.
And how tall was the star child?
About 4 feet tall. The human was about, based on the size of her skull, which is about 12, her skull holds about 1,200 cubic centimeters of brain. That's the size of somebody about 5 feet tall. And that's a common height for people of Mexican heritage today. 5 feet tall is not unusual. So she was about 5 feet tall. The girl said, the skeleton in the grave was noticeably smaller than the one lying beside it. Noticeably smaller, that's all she said. So we go with 4 feet tall because people who see gray aliens, the small gray aliens, or the tall ones and the small ones, people who see the small gray aliens say they're about 4 feet tall, 3 to 4 feet tall. So we figure that makes sense.
All right. Okay. I did want to get to your intervention theory tonight, but we don't really have any more time. So maybe we'll have you back on at some point to talk about that.
Okay.
But meanwhile, why don't you tell people where they can find you online, where they can get your essentials for the Star Child and for your intervention theory?
Well, again, that's starchildproject.com. That's it, basically, starchildproject.com. And if you go to that, you can find very easily Star Child Skull Essentials, which I would recommend as a first read. And if you like that, then you can, and you want to know more, and you want to know more about the background and the details, then get the book, which is called The Star Child Skull. And that will really fill you in on the backstory, who all the major players were at the beginning, how the story unfolded in considerable detail, and it's a fascinating story. It really is. So that's the way to do it. StarChildProject, all one word, .com.
And what about the intervention theory?
Well, intervention theory essentials, that's on my personal website, LloydPye.com. LloydPye.com, www.lloydpye.com, and that one is called Intervention Theory Essentials, and that is more about the electric universe and the things that we were talking about, like that, human origins, an alternative view of human origins, hominoids, Bigfoot, the abominable snowman, plenty of that. So I would recommend that, and the book about that is called Everything You Know Is Wrong.
And that was published when?
Back in 97, but it's amazing how well it sells even today. You know, history, deep history, doesn't change that much, so it's pretty much the same as it was then, and, people are still buying it and reading it and liking it, so.
Okay. And you have a YouTube channel as well that you post videos to.
A lot of videos on YouTube, and you can go look at those, and if you like what you see on the videos, then, consider the books.
All right, so what's the next step for you?
Well, I'm having a health challenge right now, so I'm on my way for some treatment with that. And when I get that squared away, I will then be working on I'm going to update the Lloyd Pye website. I'll be doing more books, more videos, and I'm going to be focusing more on the intervention theory and the hominoids and other people who are now involved with the Star Child, more business-oriented than I am. We'll be taking the Star Child over that last hurdle of getting the money and recovering the full genome. So it's all in good hands, and I'm feeling very good about that.
All right. Well, thank you very much for all your work you've done on this and for coming on tonight to talk about it.
Well, thank you. I hope you're able to spread the word somewhat and that your audience is pleased to learn about it.
All right. Well, we're going to take you out with some Psyche Corporation, and Last Exit for the Lost is up next.
Come in. Understand the numbers pouring over your connection to perfection. 5, 8, 3. Have you heard the singing soaking into our transmission? 21, 34, 55, 89, 144. Can you hear the ballet? now it's time to be wary. You are getting to the heart of the universe. Ventricles and tight rehab, chambers numbered 1597 and counting.